You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to SS Britannia. Today's date is the 6th of March 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. As always, I have my co-host here with me today, Subal. Subal, how are you doing today?
Well, you know, I'm pissed off because the Jews are closing down my YouTube channel, but apart from that, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, you said your YouTube channel got removed last week. I went to have a look at it. It was still there.
It hasn't been removed. I'm on my second strike. So they've taken down two videos. The first video they took down was the one I did about train spotting. And the second one they took down was a video I did about the Jewish media family that runs Sweden, which is called the Bonnier media family. And that got like 3,000 views in like 4 or 5 days, and then they just shot that one down. So now I'm on my second strike. So now I'm not allowed to post videos for 2 weeks, and the strike lasts for 3 months, and if I get another strike in the coming 3 months, they'll shut the channel down.
I think this is a problem that quite a few people have come across. The way to solve it is to set up another channel, and you'd have to basically get a new email address, set up a new Google account, and set up a new channel. I don't know whether you need to use Tor at first to do that, possibly not, but I think that's probably something that you should do, and it's also something that listeners should think about doing if they are involved in producing content for YouTube, is think of setting up a backup channel, because then at least you could still continue to make videos and upload them for the next couple of weeks.
No, I could probably do that, but it's a bit, you know, because the thing about when you're making YouTube videos, the thing is really, it's all about the subscribers. You're trying to get your subscriber count up there, you know, and I was just about to hit the 1K and flipping stuff, just really pissed off. So, I'm really pissed off. I've actually just been playing video games for the last 4 days. That's what I've been doing. I thought it's better than drinking, so I went to the shops and I brought myself a video game. What did I buy? I bought Black Flag. What's it called? It's Assassin's
Creed. Sounds like an anarchist game.
Huh?
Sounds like an anarchist game.
No, it's about pirates. Black Flag. Yeah, it sounds like an anarchist game. So I've been playing a pirate game for the last 4 days. I've just totally blotted out everything. I'm really annoyed,
productive.
Actually. I put a lot of time and effort into that channel.
That's what I'm saying. You know, you should set up another channel, and I'm sure that your subscribers, if once you let them know, they would all subscribe to that one.
Yeah,
you'd
have slowly,
two lots.
Maybe, yeah.
I think that's,
no, don't worry. I'm not giving up. I'm just annoyed, expressing my annoyance. So there you go. I mean, it's like a personal strike. You know, it's one thing to watch all the garbage that goes on in the news, but and when it actually affects your life and something that you put a lot of effort into yourself, and then it just gets flipping shut down just because some bullshit thought crime. It's just really annoying. I'm really pissed off.
I understand. You're pissed off. I think I'm pretty lucky that we haven't really had that happen to Radio Aryan, but I did think when we first started doing it, I thought, well, we don't want to risk that happening, so that's why we didn't go on SoundCloud, and that's why we didn't go on YouTube and set up a separate archive, which was far less likely to do anything like that, because a lot of people have said before, why don't you go on SoundCloud? That would enable you to reach a lot more people than you actually do. But people get removed from SoundCloud. I've seen instrumental bands get removed from SoundCloud. Fascist music, which hasn't even got any lyrics in it, that SoundCloud have removed from there. And obviously with YouTube, they remove stuff. So you know, I can appreciate what you do. It must be very hard to see all your hard work removed like that. So, you know, you've got a lot of integrity to keep doing it, because that's what they're hoping, is that you'll give up. They're hoping that all these attacks on you and these strikes against you will make you give up. And you, and obviously you're not going to give up, because
there's no option.
Yeah,
really.
You just got to keep going.
I mean, just to make it clear, I mean, the only option is it's fight or die. I mean, our back's against the wall. Unless we fight this thing, then England's going to turn into an Islamic nation. And that's not a country that I want to live in. So we don't really have any choice. So, yeah, it's just a bump in the road. I don't know.
Well, I've got some statistics. You don't want to see England turn into an Islamic nation. I've got some statistics that we can start off with. In the last 5 years in Britain, terrorism has trebled. Three times as much terrorism as there originally was. 10% of it is all centred around Muslim ghettos in Birmingham. And also in the last 5 years, beheadings and stabbings. We now have 11 times as many beheadings and stabbings. And as far as I'm aware, I don't think we had any beheadings up until recently. I think the last person to be beheaded was King Charles II. And so now it's Muslims doing it. Back then, yeah. That was the Jews that were encouraging that, even though it was William Cromwell that was responsible. He was being encouraged and funded by the Jews. So yeah, this is what, we don't want this to increase again. And you think 20 times as many beheadings and stabbings it will be in another 5 years' time. We've got to put a stop to it.
I didn't know we had any beheadings. I never seen that on the news. You'd think that would make the newspaper, but I guess they didn't want to show that story.
Well, there was Lee Rigby. There was this granny as well that got beheaded. They tried to, the Negroes tried to behead a policeman a decade or so back. And they tried to say, it was a stabbing. But they tried to behead him. This is the sort of thing that non-whites will do when they get excited. They don't have the self-control that white people do. They don't have the self-control that right-wing white people do. To move into Trump news today, yesterday there was a rally in Berkeley in America, and it was the Proud Boys, the alt-light, that were having a march, peaceful march. They just wanted to say what they believe in and show their support for Donald Trump. And the leftists were there, and the leftists were physically attacking them with pepper spray. They pepper sprayed some poor old man, looks about 70 years old. He's just lying there in the grass, having been sprayed by this pepper spray. People covered in blood. People that actually turned up there from the Proud Boys with helmets and shields and protection. And I think this is what nationalists, patriots, are going to have to do in the future when they go to demonstrations. They're going to need to dress up in protective gear as if they're going out on a motorcycle or something. And what gets me about this is these people are going out there to support Donald Trump. Why isn't he protecting them? Why isn't Donald Trump protecting his supporters when they go out to support him? He's the president. He can tell the police that they've got to buck their ideas up and protect the people that are supporting him. And again, this moves into something else that another bit of a criticism that I have of him. He's also just come out and said about Obama having put bugs in Trump Tower, trying to listen in on what Donald Trump was saying. Well, why tweet about it? Why hasn't he done something about it? And this comes from reading Harold Covington's tweets. And I was just thinking, well, Harold Covington can only send tweets, but Donald Trump is the president. He can do something about this. He doesn't need to send a tweet saying Obama has been bugging Trump Tower. He could send someone around to arrest Obama. He could set up an investigation into it. He doesn't need to complain about it online. He really needs to, I think, realize the power that he has and start flexing his muscles with it. Because if he doesn't, then the left are just going to get away with what they're doing. And he's just going to be impotent, sending tweets. He really needs to show the strength that he has, I think. He needs to stop these attacks on his supporters that are going out there to support him. and he should act, and then he should tweet. He should say, I've set up an investigation into Obama, into why he did this, not just tweet about it.
Yeah. So I I don't have the answer to that question, unfortunately. I would say it seems to me that he's fighting with the deep state, and it's just very difficult for us to know what's going on behind closed doors. And as far as I can see it, he still doesn't have all of his people in office, so maybe he just can't. I mean, from what I can see of his character, he seems like the kind of person who would shut down these protesters if he could. I mean, I'm just saying that from seeing his rallies and from seeing the way that he always, you know, congratulated the police when they threw people out. I mean, he used to say things like, you know, I'd punch him in the face before throwing them out. So from looking at his character, he seems like the kind of guy who would shut this stuff down if he could. The only justification I could say is 'cause, he's still at war with the deep state. He still doesn't have all his pieces in place. And hopefully he's going to clamp down in the next few months. I mean, I don't know. Does he have control of the military? Does he have full control? I don't know. So, yeah, pass.
Well, yeah, I think what he needs to do is say that we need to protect free speech. And these people that are going out there to support him, they're not saying anything illegal. And the left are behaving like terrorists. They're using violence to intimidate other people because they don't like what they're saying. They're trying to shut down the opinions of another group of people because they don't like them. And that is the dictionary definition of bigot. Now, the left like to call us bigots, but they are the real bigots because they try to shut down any other opinion. They're not capable of debating the point. They're not capable of discussing these ideas. They just wish to use violence to stop them, which is why Adolf Hitler had to set up the Sturm Battalion way back then to protect the National Socialists and the people that wanted to hear Adolf Hitler speaking from the leftist violence. And yet the left will try and make out that it's National Socialists and it's nationalists and it's fascists that are violent. Yet all we see is all of this incredible violence coming from them. And them justifying it and saying that it's perfectly fine because it's self-defense against our ideas. Sooner or later, so something's got to be done about it, because otherwise I think what we're going to see is the violence is going to escalate and we're going to end up with dead bodies over differences in politics.
Yeah, it's incredibly hypocritical. I mean, that's the Jewish thing at the end of the day, isn't it? They are the victims. They play the victim while at the same time, unleashing wave after wave after wave of violence upon you. It's just incredible how they get away with it. I mean, I don't know how any sane person can do it, but that's the thing. That's the kind of people that you're dealing with. You're dealing with people who are genuinely not interested in the truth and who are basically, they're overrided by emotion. They're not rational people. They follow their emotions because it's very feminine. The left wing in general is just utterly feminine. There's no logic there. It's just they feel this way, and so they feel justified to do what they're doing because they feel that it's justified. And, you know, the rational side of it, you know, the hypocrisy, it just doesn't matter to them at all. And yeah, they'll just use massive amounts of violence. And I hope Trump's going to bring down the hammer. I mean, I'm waiting. You're waiting. It's been a month. What can I say? I hope he's going to bring it down.
Hammer time. That's what hammer we're time. Waiting for. Hammer time.
Yeah. Bring out the National Guard or something. I don't know.
As you were saying there with this Jewish technique, it is a Jewish technique, isn't it? It's the Jew cries while he stabs you. They will cry that they're the victim while at the same time stabbing the innocent nationalists, the innocent patriot. But just to go into some more Trump news, we've also got Tony Blair, who has been talking to Jared Kushner, who's the Jewish husband of Ivanka Trump, about becoming a Middle East peace envoy. Now, I can't see this happening because Donald Trump has spoken a lot about how how unfortunate and how ridiculous this war against Iraq was and how much it's cost America. And Tony Blair was one of the chief architects of this pointless war in Iraq, which has led to the creation of ISIS. So why on earth would Donald Trump be thinking about employing the one of the chief architects of that war as the Middle East peace envoy? Doesn't make any sense to me. Plus, we've also got Tony Blair, who announced a couple of weeks ago that he was going to have a crusade to stop Brexit, and he was going to put all this money into doing all he could to mess up Britain's plans to leave the European Union. And Donald Trump has said that he's really pleased that Britain is leaving the European Union. And the ambassador that he has sent to the European Union has said how proud he is of the fact that he brought down the Soviet Union, and he hopes to do the same for the European Union. So it would be some very disjointed thinking if Tony Blair was taken on by the Trump administration. I really hope it doesn't happen. And it is interesting that it's a Jew that's trying to organize it.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's pretty shameless on Tony Blair's. Well, I mean, he's a shameless person, but I mean, from a political point of view, I think it's just stupid because he's just making a fool out of himself. There's no way that Trump's going to give him a job, and he's cozying up to this Jared Kushner guy. That guy doesn't have any power. I mean, the Jews themselves, they're writing articles saying how, you know, Trump doesn't listen to him, and Trump just listens to Steve Bannon, and Jared Kushner keeps getting shut out from all the meetings, and etc., etc. So he's got no power at all. I mean, that they're praying and hoping that he can be the court Jew and that he can have some influence over Trump. But, you know, his idea of influencing Trump is to bring in Tony Blair, you know, the guy that started the Iraq war and the guy that wants to block Brexit. And then the guy's a complete moron. What are they thinking? I don't know. I think it's just... Yeah, I mean, I saw the headline and I just thought that is just the most retarded thing ever. It just made me laugh, to be honest with you. I don't think it will ever happen, ever, ever. So I'm not worried about it. I think poor old Tony's just embarrassing himself, really.
Well, it's good to hear that Jared Kushner has been shut out of the meetings. I hadn't heard that. I'm very pleased to hear that. I'm still praying that there'll be a divorce between Ivanka and Jared Kushner, which would obviously tend to alter Donald Trump's views of the Jews, I would have thought. Well,
funny enough, just as you mentioned that, funny enough, I read a interview by Donald Trump from 2005. Somebody posted, anyway, somewhere on the internet, I read this interview, and he's talking about his daughter, and apparently his daughter used to fancy Tom Brady, you know, the guy that just won the Super Bowl. And Trump was saying, like, oh, yeah, I'd be really proud if Tom Brady was my son-in-law. It'd be really great. But then she ended up marrying this Jew. Bit of a shame, isn't it, really? But there you go.
That is a shame. That is a shame. Yeah. Well, maybe this Super Bowl footballer, he should get in there.
He's married to some. He's got a supermodel girlfriend. She's Brazilian, but she's not really Brazilian. She's, like, you know, Germanic, tall, like, blonde hair, blue eyes.
One of the white Brazilians. Yeah, there are still some white Brazilians. Very many. But there are some. Okay.
No, I've been to Brazil. I mean, there's quite a few white people down there. They're not like Mexicans. I mean, this is one thing perhaps, I don't know if Americans know this, but the Mexicans, their blood is very, very, you know, mixed up and intermingled with Aztec blood. That's why they have these kind of like blobby like features with the big nose, and they just look like a giant blob, you know.
They're squat, aren't they?
They do. They look very blobby. Yeah, they just look fat and whatever. But it's not like that down in Brazil. No, they're basically Portuguese, most of them. So there's a lot of, I mean, of course there is a lot of race mixing, but at the same time there's a lot of kind of Portuguese blood people down there. And yeah, it's nice. I mean, Brazil is nice. I lived there for a while. It's great.
Very violent. Very violent.
Very violent. My God. Gunshots. You just hear them echoing across the hills, you know. Da 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 da. I saw a helicopter gunfight in Brazil. It's flipping awesome. I couldn't believe it. I was like, hear this noise. I was sleeping. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning, and there's this noise. Like, whoa, 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 whoa. And I'm like, what the hell? And I get up and I'm looking out the window, and there's the boppy. That's like the SWAT team for Rio, you know? And they're in this big black helicopter, and he's like going up and down over the hills. Looked like a giant bumblebee or something, you know? And some guy's leaning out of it with his giant shotgun, just going. Yeah, it was awesome. I was just like, wow, this is cool. But yeah, it's really violent.
Incredibly the multicultural violent. Utopia. That's what happens. Brazil is a perfect example of what happens when you encourage miscegenation. And if you look at South America, and particularly Brazil, it was settled at the same time as North America. It had far more natural resources than North America. And yet they didn't enforce the same segregation. What happened was they encouraged the Negroes and the Indians to join them when they rose up against Spain and Portugal for their independence. And they said, well, we'll make you all equal citizens. And once they made them all equal citizens, the Pope said that it was fine for the whites to intermarry with these with these mestizos. Well, they ended up creating mestizos, intermarry with the Indians and the Negroes, and you ended up with all these different shades of brown. And once that happened, the average IQ was lowered, and you've obviously got all the other problems that come from having mixed race people, which leads to Brazil being one of the most violent places on the planet, with helicopter gunships and shots being fired off all the time, compared to the white areas in America. Because South America should, by if it had remained white, it would have been a more wealthier place than North America. The only reason that it's not is because of all the miscegenation that went on. And that, looking at Brazil, that's where the rest of the world is headed for if we don't start enforcing racial segregation laws, if we don't start making it illegal for white people to do that to their children. I think it comes down to the rights of the child. The child should have a right to ancestors, should have a right to being born into one of the races that were created by nature. It should not be allowed for them to be genetically modified into something that has no ancestors, that wasn't designed by nature, that was purely designed through the lust of man with no thoughts for the consequences. I think it should be a human right for a child to have ancestors. And I think maybe that's the best way to put it. Because people might say, oh, yes, but of course the child has ancestors. He's got a mother and a father and grandparents. Yes, but the grandparents and the great-grandparents won't look anything like the child if he's mixed race. So they won't be his ancestors because they won't look anything like them. And they won't be anything like them. And this is one of the wonderful things about having white ancestors. If you look back at the old photographs, you could look back three or four generations and you'll find somebody that looks just like you or just like your brother, just like the sister. And if you look at the things that they did, the trades that they had, you'll find that they're just the same as you. If you've got musicians in the family, well, that's it. There'll be musicians in the family and it will go all the way back. If you've got a mixed race person, they're going to be nothing like those ancestors. They're not going to be able to look at those ancestors and say, ah, oh, that's where I got this from. It's depriving the child of that. A horrific thing to do. And I do believe that it's not done with malice and aforethought. It's done by people that just don't think about the consequences. Because that's one of our main problems that we have today, is people just don't think about the consequences of their actions. Brazil is the consequence of white people's actions in South America.
Yeah, people are basically divorced from their history and from their ancestors. Yeah, and you need a system of eugenics in society, otherwise everything just collapses down into nothingness. I mean, before it wasn't called eugenics, but before we used to have marriage and the church would watch over it. And unless the vicar or the priest or whoever is running the church, unless he agreed to allow you to get married, then you're not going to marry that person. And so, you know, this kind of thing was, this kind of race mixing thing was stopped because of that. So there's always been a system of eugenics of some form in society. And without it, then people just end up marrying whoever they want to marry, or just they don't even get married. You know, they breed with whoever they want to breed with, and they just create these children. And you're right, yeah, it is the children that suffer, because they're halfway here, they're halfway there, they don't know where they fit in with the world. You know, you hear this a lot with the Asians, isn't it? Because a lot of white guys now, they're chasing after Asian girls, because I guess they're more feminine than the ultra feminist white girls in America. And they get themselves an Asian wife, but then the kids, you know, the Asian girls don't want to have a half Asian boyfriend. They want an Asian boyfriend, and white girls aren't interested in a half Asian kid either. So the kids left in this limbo land, and it just sucks all round.
It's the children that suffer. Careful. It's the children that suffer. The word that I was trying to think of earlier is genetic similarity theory. This is one of the wonders of genetic similarity theory. We tend to pick our friends and our spouses that tend to have more than 60% of the same heritable genes that we have, which is why musicians and woodworking and all these various different trades and skills get passed down in the family, and why your ancestors will look similar to you, because your family line will pick out spouses that are similar to one another. This is why people say, well, boys tend to pick wives that are like their mothers. It's because of this genetic similarity theory, and it goes all the way back through the generations. You end up picking people with similar inheritable genes to what you have, which carries on these skills through all the generations. And now that we've messed all that up, and we have all this promotion of race mixing going on in the television, in the schools, in parliament, and music, and everywhere else, because of all that interfering with it, people tend to be marrying people just because of what they look like, or sleeping with people just because of what they look like. They don't think as deeply about it as they used to before. And you end up with these race mixed people that can't possibly have the skills or the looks of the ancestors, and are divorced from the past.
Yeah. And you also, some people just get knocked up, you know, so they get married just because they got pregnant, which I suppose is better than getting an abortion. But, you know, I remember I knew a girl once who worked in a flower shop, and obviously she did a lot of weddings and funerals, right? And she told me that she really could tell when people get married. She could tell the difference between the marriages that would work and the marriages that wouldn't work, because the people that they came in and they were really like super anxious and stressed out about the marriage, and oh, you got to make sure it's perfect, and did it, and you know, really like stressed out about it. They're the ones that are placing far too much emphasis on the marriage, and not enough, you know, they're the ones that have got actual problems. And the ones that are really relaxed about it and just casual and laid back, and it's kind of like a natural thing, those are the marriages that work. So you can see, I mean, even in white on white relationships, there's certain people match, and it all flows naturally, and they fit together, and certain people don't, and they're just mismatched couples who, because of all the social chaos that we're surrounded by, they just end up getting married to people who they don't really love, they don't really connect with, and it just creates disorder. You can really see it. Some people are meant to be together, they look comfortable together, they get married, they form a nice happy family, you can see that they're on the same wavelength, and some people don't. And yeah, it's probably got a lot to do with, well, it's definitely got a lot to do with genetics and what, you know, what your nature is, basically. Yeah.
I've read I think it was in Flavius Josephus and other Roman works around that time, and they really looked down on people that married for lust. That was something that the animals did, and the peasants marrying for lust. And if you look at the ancient Hindu system with the caste system, they would marry people only if their horoscopes were correct and they were part of the same caste. It never was about marrying for lust. That's only come about in the last 100-150 years. And just the other day, they had a big women's march in London. Of course, they're not talking about the white girls in Rotherham or the Muslim rape gangs in Britain and what they're doing to the women. What they're complaining about is arranged marriage in the third world, complaining about arranged marriage in India. Well, India used to have only less than 1% of marriages used to end up in divorce. And since the feminists have gone over there and encouraged feminism and said, oh, it's all wrong to have arranged marriages, they now have a serious problem with divorce over there and a serious rape problem. And it all comes from, say, encouraging people to marry because they've fallen in love. And it used to be that you married who your parents told you to marry. And if you were lucky, then you might grow to be in love with that person. And when they interview these people, these Indians that have these arranged marriages, they'll never find any of them over the age of 30 that will say that it was bad or their husband mistreated them. And the ones that they talk to that are in their 40s and their 50s, they're some of the happiest women that I've ever seen. And they never married because they fell in love. They married who they were told to marry. And they married someone who was their equal, who their parents thought was going to be best for them. So they weren't blinded by lust. They married for good reasons. They honored their parents. And that used to be the same for white people. I know only in the last few centuries it's only been for the upper classes of white people, but that used to be the same for all whites.
Yeah, well, unless you get the father's, you know, the father has to give his daughter away. I mean, that's where the tradition comes from, where the father walks the girl up to meet the bride. But India, arranged marriages, it does work. I mean, I have to say, the system, I mean, they have different, well, let me say, it depends what part of India you go to. The system works really well in Bengal. And how it works is basically there's two marriages. So what will happen is that the girl, when she's, you know, before she reaches puberty, she'll be married to a guy, but obviously, you know, she's not yet a woman, so she doesn't live with the guy. She just meets the guy. They have the first marriage, and she'll meet the guy and she'll have his photo. And then from then on, like once a month or something like this, she'll go and visit the guy, or the guy will come to her house and she'll like cook for him and whatever. And then when she reaches puberty, when she's like 16, then she has the second marriage, and then she gets married. She marries the guy, and usually they don't ever get divorced, I mean, because it's fixed up. And how it works is that basically, you know, if you look at any young girl, when she's always dreaming of Prince Charming, right? The knight and the white horse coming to rescue her. But if you actually marry the girl when she's like 10 years old, then all of those fantasies, they get directed towards her future husband, you see. And obviously they arrange it according to caste. And so you've got like a genetically, you know, it's all fixed up, caste and clan and everything. And the astrology as well, which is actually really important, and it does work. The girl falls in love with the guy. You know, you're like 16 years old. The guy that she'll marry will be like 4 or 5 years older than her. And, you know, like when you're 16 and you see a guy that's, or, you know, if you're a boy and you see a guy that's 20, you think, oh, wow, he's like, you know, he really knows what's going on. You know, so you can imagine if you're a 16-year-old girl and you marry some guy who's like 20 years old, it's like, wow, he's like, you know, he knows everything. You know, he's like, he's like super. You know, so they really fall in love. I mean, they genuinely fall in love, and they stay married and they don't get divorced. And the other thing is they have a bunch of kids straight away. It's basically within the first year you have a baby, and if you don't have a baby, your marriage is not considered to be a success. People like, you know, the neighbors will start asking questions like what went wrong? You know, what's going wrong in the bedroom department, you know? it's a system that really works well, but it works in Bengal. In other parts of India, it's broken down. In Madhya Pradesh, which is the part of India where, Delhi is, Delhi and Mathura and other places. In that part of this country, the system's totally broken down because there's too much emphasis on finance and too much emphasis on the guy's got to have a bit of money before he gets married. And don't ask me why the system broke that. I don't know, but there is. So a lot of the guys don't get married until they're 30. And some of the women as well don't get married until their late 30s as well. And so what you have, basically all the guys, they just go to Delhi to screw prostitutes for like 10, 15 years. And then they get married and their wife's already old. So that the system's really broken down in that part of the country. But Bengal, it works. The system does work. It's just you have to get married when you're young, you know, otherwise the guy's just going to screw prostitutes.
It seems very well thought out. As you say, the boys tend to mature a little bit later than girls, and a girl of 16 is going to be looking at somebody of 20. They are going to be looking up to him. So it's very well thought out that she's going to project all her fantasies of Prince Charming onto the future husband rather than onto anyone else. And this is why they would protect them from seeing young boys as well. And this is the same in white societies. We would protect the maidens from being seen by the men in case they would fall in love with somebody other than the husband that they were supposed to fall in love with. And the dowry, which is another thing that the feminists complain about, oh, it's so terrible that women are being bought for money and they're seen as property. Well, the reason for that is so that the husband would pay out money so that he valued his wife, because he'd had to pay out a lot of money or a lot of cows or a lot of livestock. He made a huge investment paid out for that wife, and that would ensure that he would then look after her. And at the same time, the wife would feel that she was valued because he'd put up all these precious things so that he could marry her. And she would want to live up to his expectations of place paying all that value out for her. And that was the system. It wasn't, oh, we're selling this woman like a slave, as the feminists promote it. It was to show how much value the maiden was worth to the husband. He was prepared to pay out all this amount of money just so that he could marry you. That's how much he valued you for. A completely different way of looking at it to this wicked, evil feminist way of describing it. I hate what they've done to the third world and to arranged marriage. If you compare that to the huge divorce rate that we have and the broken families and all the poor children that don't have two parents there, And we'll go over to these third world countries and tell them that our way is best, and we'll dazzle them with all the trinkets and the baubles, and they'll fall for it, and their countries and their nations will be destroyed through it, which is what we're seeing happen to India.
Yeah, I mean, some of the worst feminists in the world come from India. I mean, India is, I don't know, it's kind of, there's a division. If you can find these traditional humble Indian girls, but you really have to go out into the jungle, into the villages. If you're in the big city, if you're in Delhi or anywhere like that, the girls are just awful. I mean, they're just ultra feminist. I mean, these are some of the worst feminist girls you're ever going to meet. I mean, they're just terrible. And it's absolute poison. Just about the point about the dowry, in India, the system works different. In India, it's the father who gives his daughter away. He gives a dowry with the daughter. So he'll give his daughter to the future husband. And with that daughter, he'll give, you know, money and cows and stuff like that. The original idea, I think, was that, he'd give his daughter a bunch of jewels and things like this, and she would keep them. And that would kind of be like a wealth that she'd be able to keep for herself, you know, 'cause it's her jewelry. And, you know, in case anything happened to her husband or whatever, but it worked the other way around. You don't buy your wife. You give your wife away. And there's also a concept. I mean, the Indians are really finicky about this. It's the idea of, once you've given something, you never take it back. It's considered really like offensive. They just won't accept anything back. Like, if you if you give a donation like to a holy man, you'll never ever take that money back off from him or ask for that money back. It's considered to be like poison, you know, because giving a charity is such an important thing for them. So the idea is that you give your daughter in charity and you won't take her back. You won't take anything in return from your son-in-law. They're quite finicky about it, but yeah.
So I guess the dowry system there works that this is a nest egg for you. I'll give you all these gifts along with my wife and that will help you to set up home. So it's, again, it's a different way. I must have been thinking of other ways because the dowry system has been in place with all white nations originally. They always had some form of dowry system. It wasn't buying and selling slaves as the feminists would have us believe. Well, we could move on to...
Sorry, just to continue the point. I mean, it's also getting messed up as well in India, unfortunately, because now they have this horrible situation where women, they get married and their fathers give their dowry to the family and then they demand more money. And then they've got this woman, they keep her as a hostage and they threaten to kill her. Stuff, it's just mental. It's just, I got to say, it's some of the stuff that goes on in India is just mental. I got to say, it's not the Hindus, it's the Muslims. They've really poisoned that country with the whole... Because Hinduism is such a gentle religion. And, you know, in Hinduism, people worship goddesses and things like this. There's a lot of feminine energy, a lot of appreciation for the mother and for females in general. But these Muslims, with their bad mood and their bad vibe, they've just ruined the country. And what they do is like I say, a girl will get married, and then the husband, he'll demand more money from that girl's family, and he'll use that... his wife as a hostage. Sometimes they even kill the wife. It's nuts. These people are absolute savages, I gotta say. It's just horrible. But yeah, anyway, there you go.
Well, I would think a lot of that comes from the miscegenation that was forced on the country when the Muslims moved in there and destroyed the caste system and destroyed the biological integrity of that system. You still had white people there originally, and now you haven't, and it's caused these problems with the culture, and we end up with it today, and we end up with making it worse by introducing feminism to it. Mm. I would suggest there's probably a biological component there, as well as the religious component. It's all fascinating stuff.
But you meet some of the Indians; they're very, very humble. You know, they're very, they can be very soft and gentle. But then you meet the Muslims and they're just flipping horrible. It's like there's still this division there. Oh, it really, sorry to interrupt. It just really gets my wick. And especially like in the last week, I've been having so many arguments with my devotee friends because they're like, oh, the Muslims, we got to invite them in. And it's just, they're so stupid. I mean, these are the people that, they raped the country. They burnt down temples. I mean, they hate Hindus. And I've got devotees that defend them. It's utterly moronic. But, oh, God.
No, they split India the country really in half, to, didn't they? They literally split the country in half.
Oh, it's just a joke. I mean, they're just scum. They're just utter scum. And the Indians, they've just been psychologically broken, basically. They're just psychologically broken, just kind of like we are. Basically, they've got these invaders in the country. They've got their independence from England now. They outnumber the Muslims like 10 to 1 still, thankfully. And all they got to do is just crush them. Basically, crush them, invade Bangladesh, take that back. Because there's still a lot of Hindus in Bangladesh. And, you know, forget about Pakistan. That's gone. Forget it. But yeah. Crush the Muslims. Or they got, it's like a sleeping giant. They're just sitting there getting raped and murdered by Muslims and they're not doing anything. It's awful. They're just, psychologically broken. What can I say?
Well, wherever Muslims go, they cause these problems, don't they? They've got the same problems in China, same problems in Burma with them, with the Buddhists there and in Thailand. And I would suggest, I mean, some of the listeners might think, well, why are you going on about India? They're not white people, but that was originally white people there And looking at India,
yeah,
that's what's going to happen to us if we don't put a stop to it now. We need to learn from the past. We need to learn from what happened in India, because the same thing is happening in Britain and in Europe today. And it's the same people. It's the Muslims that are doing it. Obviously, you've got the Jews that open the gates, as they always do. But the Muslims are the shock forces. They're the troops that are being used to do this. The Muslims and the Jews working in tandem together. But we've got to learn from it. And also, I feel a certain amount of compassion for them. I know they're not my race, but I still feel compassion for what's happening over there. In a different way to the way that I feel about white people. But like any living being, you don't want to see it persecuted. You don't want to see it hurt. I don't like to see what the Israelis do to the Palestinians. But at the same time, that's not so much, that's not my problem. That's the Palestinians' problem over there. It's good propaganda to show to white people, to show them what the Jews are like. But it's not something that I'd get involved in, save the Palestinians. It seems I wouldn't get involved in anything in India, but I do still have compassion for what's happening to them. And I do think it's helpful to look at the system that they have in India, because there are a lot of similarities with that to the way that white nations used to be, and the caste system and the honouring of the ancestors and the arranged marriages. They still have a lot of cultural things that that we no longer have in the West. So I think it's instructive to learn about it.
Yeah, this is what people realized in the 19th century. This is where the word Aryan comes from. It comes from India. There's a connection between the European languages and the European culture. But I think they specifically noticed it with the languages and Sanskrit, the ancient language of India. And there's connections with the culture as well. We don't have the same connection with China, and we definitely don't have the same connection with Africa, but there is kind of there is a bond. And if you ever go to India, you can see most of the Indians, they love you. I mean, they're like, oh, from England, oh, very good. You know, they they're definitely Anglophiles, or what would you say for America? I don't know, Amerophiles? I don't know. But no, they definitely like white people. There is a strong connection there. What to say? It's just sad. Yeah, that civilization was destroyed.
I've been reading a lot of L.A. Waddell's work recently. I've been reading his work on Egypt and on the Sumerian alphabet and Aryan origins of civilization. And his theory was basically that you had an Aryan homeland that was in Cappadocia in Asia Minor, and they moved from there into Mesopotamia, became the ruling force in Mesopotamia over the black-headed people, the Sumerians, and then they formed a colony over in India, and they also formed a colony over in Egypt. And they started off the pharaohs in Egypt, and they started off the kingly lines in India. And when you look at the records that they have of the Indian kings and the Sumerian rulers and the Egyptian pharaohs, there's a lot of similarity between them, whether it's in the words themselves, the names themselves, or what the names actually meant. So what he's suggesting is that the Mesopotamian civilization, the Indian civilization, and the Egyptian civilization were all started by these same people, and it all comes from looking at the alphabets and the kingly lists that they have. So his suggestion is that was the original the Aryan source of the civilization that they had in India, and the names for they had the same gods as well, like Vishnu, symbol of the fish. And there are images in Sumeria and Mesopotamia of this fish god. And also Bacchus, the Greek god, was apparently one of these Sumerian kings, Bacchus, which explains why he built this bridge across the Euphrates, which is part of the myths of Bacchus. And he looks at the origins of a lot of these gods and says, well, they were originally these first Aryan kings of these first great empires. And Sargon as well. And he makes it clear that these weren't Semitic. And when he's talking about Semitic, he means Arab type. not necessarily descended from Shem in the Bible, but the Semitic type, the Arab type, because most of the researchers now will try to say that there are either links with Jews and Arabs or not, because the Arabs have tried to take over this this history, especially in Egypt. They will tell you that the pyramids were all built by Arabs, when they clearly weren't. You only have to look at the mummies to know that they weren't Arabs. I think Tutankhamun shares 99% of his DNA with North Europeans, something similar. I mean, you can see these red-haired mummies and these blonde-haired mummies. And we've got the mummies in the Tukharians, the Taklamakan desert there from 4,000 years ago, which are clearly white people. And they were clearly highly advanced. And obviously, in India, they have it was originally peopled with a caste of white people. They also had other races there. They had the Dravidians there and other peoples there. And things got on okay when you have a caste system, when you keep things separate. But as soon as you start introducing equality and interbreeding between the castes, it all falls apart. And the same things, I would suggest, has happened in Egypt, Babylon, Mesopotamia, as in India. It's just that in India, we've still got the closest link with them for some reason. Maybe they were the last one to fall, Subal. Maybe they, because they still had, must have still had white people up there for the first millennium after Christ. Well, when was it that the Muslims actually went in and invaded?
Now you're asking. Oh dear, now you're asking. 800 AD, something like that. I don't know. There is a famous battle which kind of marks the conquest, but no, I can't remember altogether. It was connected with the Mongols because so it would have been after Genghis Khan, because the Muslims that invaded were known as not Mongols, Mughals. The name was similar to Mongol. So something around that time. Yeah, well, it's interesting, actually. Muhammad's actually predicted I was meaning to do a video on this, but anyway. Muhammad's actually was actually predicted in the Bhavishya Purana, which is the future Purana, which is kind of like the Nostradamus of the Vedas or something like this. And they predicted that he would appear and cause all kinds of disturbances. And the great conspiracy surrounding Islam in the Hare Krishna world, or that Hindus know. Every Hindu knows, I don't know if every Hindu knows this, but people that are into, you know, in the intellectuals and stuff. The great conspiracy is that there was a Shiva Linga in the Mecca, you see. And for those of you who don't know what Shiva Linga is, Shiva is, he's the god of destruction. He's a Hindu god. He has a trident and dreadlocks. And the Shiva Linga is basically like a black stone, you see. And they say that there was a Shiva Linga in the Mecca. And that's what they used to worship there. And then Muhammad came along and he smashed the Linga. And if you see on the side of the Kaaba, this black thing on the side, there's this thing. It's called a black stone. And you can Google it and you can look at the image and it looks like a broken Shiva Linga. And that is right at the center of Islam. That's what they pray to five times a day. They get down on their knees and pray to this thing. And there are other similarities as well. I mean, there's the half crescent moon. You see that the Muslims like to use. That's also a symbol of Shiva because he has the moon in his hair, in his dreadlocks. If you look at a picture of Shiva, he's got that symbol there. There's also just a general connection between, you know, Shiva is the god of destruction and the god of the mode of ignorance or the mood of ignorance. And he's also very atheistic and impersonalistic. And the Muslims are like that. You know, they're in the mode of ignorance. They're very angry. They're very aggressive. And their conception of God is very impersonal. Like Allah is just, I don't know what he is, a giant white light or something. You know, it's not like the beautiful personal religion that you have in, you know, the Catholic religion with Mary and Jesus, and it's more loving, you know, their conception is very dry, very impersonal. So, that's the big conspiracy, that there was a Shiva Linga in the Mecca, and then Muhammad basically broke it and started his bogus religion.
Well, that would make sense with this, what L.A. Waddell was saying, that it was the same gods, they just had different names and the same symbols that were in India as well as in Suma and around that area. So if there was a Shiva Linga in Mecca, then that would fit in with that. And that would also tend to imply that the destruction of the castes didn't happen in India until about 1,000 years ago, which would mean it was fairly recent that happened. Now, I've seen evidence of these huge universities that they had over there, massive universities, the biggest universities in the world, and people would go there in order to study. And this was from around 2,000 years ago and further on from them. And the students would have their costs paid for, and they would study all these really technical ideas. I mean, if you look at the architecture that they have over there in India, yeah, I mean, some of it's fantastic, but they're not capable of doing that now. This would have been going way back to that time. So it's probably very recent that actually happened, I would have thought, especially if the Muslims went in 800.
They do still build traditional temples in that style. It's just really expensive, so they don't do it very often. They're just really expensive. But yeah, once you build a temple like that, it'll stand for 1,000 years or more. So it's like real long-term architecture. But yeah,
in Cambodia.
God, I mean, Sanskrit's like the most amazing, incredible, in-depth language in the world. I mean, it's like meaning after meaning after meaning. You can study it your whole life and you never get to the bottom of it. So the culture's there. I mean, I personally think that Vedic culture may end up winning the culture camp, the culture war. I mean, it's definitely creeping in to Western civilization. Yoga is everywhere, practically universally accepted.
Yeah, but it's a twisting of it, isn't it? It's not real yoga. It's not the union with God, the worship with God. It's feminists trying to make themselves look physically better.
Yeah,
they've twisted it, haven't they?
Yeah, but that's the thing about the Vedas. That's the beauty of the Vedic knowledge. It's in every corner, and so you kind of you get into a little bit of it, and then you get sucked into the whole thing. So, but yeah, obviously the yoga that they practice is just a physical yoga, but still some of it's very technical. I mean, some of the breathing exercises and the meditation on the chakras. I mean, that India pretty much dominates the new age, like the hippie generation. I mean, they've taken it over. If you look at astrology, you mentioned astrology earlier, Western astrology is dead. I mean, white nationalists probably don't think about this at all, because it's not the kind of thing that white nationalists are into, but Vedic astrology, Indian astrology, is utterly decimating Western astrology, because it's better. I mean, to be quite honest with you, it's got a 5,000-year-old tradition, and they've been doing it for all this time, and it makes sense, and it really works. And then you've got martial arts. Martial arts comes from, most of the unit comes from China, but if you look at martial arts, all the martial arts trace their origins back to the Shaolin temple. But the Shaolin monks were educated by Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma came from India. He crossed the Himalayas, and he went to China, and he brought martial arts to China. So you have all these different angles where Vedic culture is seeping into Western culture. And if it wasn't for Islam just destroying and wiping everything out, then I think eventually it's going to take over, basically. I've said this before many times in my videos, but I do feel like white nationalism, we had a major loss in the cultural revolution of the 60s, because what happened is all that hippie culture, that alternative spiritualism, it was taken away from it. That used to be our energy, that used to be our movement. I mean, you look at the what was that guy called? Guido von Liszt, the great wizard of Germany. and other people like that, and the folkish movement, where they used to go out into the countryside and used to walk through the mountains, and they used to care about the environment, and they used to get into runes. These are basically like hippies. They were alternative people looking for some kind of deep mysticism, and it was all tied up with the artistic revolution of romanticism. So we had all of this energy, this vibe, this movement, and then all of a sudden the 60s revolution comes along and they took it all away from us. And now if you're interested in chakras, if you're interested in astrology, if you're interested in, you know, alternative spiritualism, if you're interested in any of this, you know, ancient civilization kind of stuff, legends and mythology and this kind of thing, you get sucked into the left wing and all with all their liberal values. And it's a great loss for us, because all of these things used to be ours. This used to be our issues, our qualities of our movement. And they helped to build Nazi Germany, and we've lost it. I personally think we need to get a bit more spiritual. I know most of the listeners at home are probably thinking, what? But I'm serious. I mean, people are drawn to this. People are drawn to astrology. They're drawn to yoga and meditation and things like this. And if white nationalism isn't offering it, then they're gonna go and join the liberals on the left.
We are drawn to these spiritual subjects. I think a large part of it is because we had a religion and we've done away with that. We allowed the Jews into it. We allowed the Jews into the church, and we allowed the Jews to subvert it all. And now we got the church promoting gay marriage. Our religious systems are ruined basically by doing that. If we could just take back the church, that would enable us to win. But we've just handed that over to them. We've just handed that over, and we've got Christians that worship the Jews, that think that the Jews are the chosen people, that think that Jesus was a Jew, and so they end up worshiping the Jews. And we do have a long and varied spiritual history as white people, and we've allowed that to be taken away from us, and we've allowed it to be stolen from us. And now when people start looking into the Eastern religions, they don't think of white people being behind them, as they did 100 years ago. They knew it was white people that were behind them. They look at it now and they think it was brown people that were behind them. And they think that the white people are terrible, and we never had a religion. All we ever had is this shallow husk of a churchianity that we have now. They don't realize that the history of it. If you look at the saints of the Catholic Church and some of the miracles and some of the amazing things that they did, is very similar to the amazing things that the Hindu sages did, because they're all originally white. That's the bit that's missing. And as you say, Subal, people just get drawn to the left once they start looking at it, because the left has taken all of that over. But we've pretty much come to the end of the podcast now. We still didn't manage to fit comics in, but I know before you finish, we did want to say thank you very, very much to Morgoth Review, who are
thanks, Morgoth,
republishing SS Britannia. So do check out Morgoth Review. I think he's got one of the best comic sections on the internet at Morgoth Review.
I think he's the best writer in the alt-right. I'm going to put that out there. I just read his last article on Adele. He's very good, you know, because what he does is he makes a little story out of it, you know. He visualizes the whole thing. He turns a philosophical point into he gives it certain characters and makes a story out of it. It's very, very effective. So yeah, thanks, Morgoth.
Very good writer, very good comment section, and now he's also got some very good podcasts on there as well, so do check that out. Okay. Thanks very much for coming on once again, Subal. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening.
Cheers.
We'll be back next week, same time, same place at Radio Aryan, and we both hope you do have a wonderful week ahead of you.
You are listening to Radio Aryan. For alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArian.com.